Yeah, so this is going to be something totally different from the previous talks and probably for the most of the rest of the conference. I won't explicitly talk about decoherence. I'll just talk about qubits, but you'll see our approach to designing a qubit is designed knowing the decoherence effects. So this is what you might call engineering or designing qubits to avoid decoherence. So we're going to use adiabatic quantum computing using a three-junction flux qubit. These are the people who are working on the project, myself. There's three engineers, George Keefe, Frank Millikan, and Jim Rosen. And pretty much now we get a lot of help from David DiVincenzo, both theoretical and guidance. We're at IBM Research in Yorktown Heights, New York. Now, in order to deal with the problems of decoherence and the problems of engineering tunability, we decided to build a qubit, and I'll talk about this later, this is just the introduction. We decided to build a qubit that can operate at a degenerate point with a tunable operating frequency. Most other qubits can't do that. The second thing we wanted to do, in order to make a machine, IBM builds computers, so this is our motivation, is to build a quantum computer. We wanted to build a qubit that operates not with microwaves, but with pulses. The idea, it's a lot easier to engineer a computer with thousands, millions of physical qubits when you don't have microwaves floating around all over the place. It's easier to do that with pulses. The second thing we realized, that most Josephson qubits and also spin-based qubits are essentially voltage-controlled oscillators. In a sense, the exact eigenfrequency which they operate at depends upon a control voltage or a control current. And if you want to do like a clock, if you look at an atomic clock or an ion trap computer, it's really a clock where every phase is known. So we decided to decouple the qubit from the environment using tuned transmission lines and also to stabilize the operating frequency of the qubit using this tuned transmission line. And that way, it's like the difference between having a crystal oscillator and a voltage-controlled oscillator. The crystal oscillator is stable. The voltage-controlled oscillator, it's almost impossible to have that thing achieve the kind of decoherence rates that you need to make a real quantum computer. So this is our motivation, and it's driven at the top-down motivation. So the qubit we chose is shown here. This is topologically what it is. This is what it actually looks like in the real world. It's basically three junctions connected by two loops. Now, in order to understand the rest of this talk, you need to understand one thing. This is what the flux we put in this big loop we call the flux. And the flux we put in the small loop here is called the control flux. And the basic idea, the way we operate our qubit, is this, if you look at this geometry, is the usual double well potential. And now, we start at zero control flux, we have a big classical potential. If we add control flux, we can controllably reduce that potential to be flatter and flatter and eventually vanish. And then we can have quantum tunneling or coherent oscillations between these two states. So that's the fundamental way we operate our qubit. It's entirely by controlling pulses of control flux. Now, so this is when we started off on this 5 years ago, this was the basic idea that we had. And we said, okay, so we're going to do this. We're going to take a classical double well potential. We adjust our qubit so we're operating there. So then we think, well, now the eigenfrequencies, the eigenwave functions, if we're localized on the left, double well potential, it's the ground state plus the ground state plus the first excited state to localize it on the left. And then we lower the potential and let the thing clearly oscillate, and then bring it back and measure on the left or the right. That was the basic idea. And, to say that again, here's the control flux, the flux in the small loop as a function of the flux. If you work out the operation of this qubit, there's a line of degenerate points. In some sense, this means there's just a double well potential that's symmetric all along this line. If we start here, go down to here where the barrier becomes very small, it will oscillate back and forth, and then we can bring it back. So we go from point A to point B by applying this control flux pulse, and it, depending upon the function of how much time we spend in point C, the system will coherently oscillate back and forth between the left and the right well, and we measure, after we come back to point A again, we should see very large Lamar-type oscillations. And that's the basic idea. And so we said, let's try this. And we tried this for months, or for years, really, 2 or 3 years. And this is the best we could do. This is the visibility, or, you know, the size of the signal. You know, we should have been getting 100% visibility here. And coherence times, it lasts forever. In fact, we were getting, maybe 5% visibility. And coherence times, it decayed very much. Now, the reason why this occurred was, it's because you can draw this pulse as being flat, right? You can draw it flat, but, you know, it's controlled by some kind of room temperature pulse generator, and it's impossible to have a flat pulse like that over such a long period of time. So that's just phase decoherence from the pulse generator itself. So basically, each experiment may be running at a slightly different frequency. So then we had the idea, why not stabilize the operating frequency of this qubit using a resonator? Now, other people have done this as well. We probably are more dependent upon this than most of the other people. So we said, let's take our qubit here, and now we're going to couple it to an harmonic oscillator. And the harmonic oscillator we chose was a transmission line, a superconducting transmission line terminated with shorts at both ends. Now, why did we choose a superconducting transmission line as opposed to some kind of LC oscillator? Well, two reasons. One is, a superconducting transmission line, you know, the eigenfrequency of that line depends upon the phase velocity and the length of the line. And the phase velocity just determines how accurately you can make the thing, but the length, you can make it very accurately. So we believe we can precisely control the eigenfrequency of our transmission line. Unlike if you had just made an LC oscillator with a capacitor, you'd have to control the capacitance exponentially, the thickness of that capacitor exponentially, which is impossible to do. Secondly, if you had any dielectric in this resonator, as people have now shown, you get tremendous amounts of loss from the dielectric. So by using a tuned superconducting transmission line, we avoid the problem. So here's this. In this case, it was a microstrip line. It's just tuned to inductively couple to one part of the qubit. So now let's look at what the eigenfrequency spectrum of this coupled qubit looks like. And you know, if you talk to people in the previous conference, they'll say, well, you know, each qubit has advantages and disadvantages. But, you know, the ion traps are great because they're perfectly coupled, decoupled from the environment. They can have very long coherence times. And the difficulty is that because they're so weakly coupled to the environment, it's very hard to, do interactions between ions. On the other hand, the standard Josephson qubit is very strongly coupled to the environment. And it's very strongly coupled to each other. So in that case, you say you can easily do interactions, but you can't get to decoherence time long enough because it's constantly, you know, being coupled to the rest of the world. So this qubit tries to finesse this problem. See, because the eigenfrequency of our qubit coupled to a harmonic oscillator spectrum looks like this. When we're down in this region here, where the basic bare eigenfrequency of the qubit is very small, it's a classical object. The two eigenspectra are on the left or the right well. In the limit where we applied a lot of control flux, and the eigenfrequency would have gone way up like this exponentially, because you know we're tunneling between two wells, and the well barrier is getting smaller and smaller. Now, the eigenfrequency is independent of the environment, because it's a harmonic oscillator. To first order, a harmonic oscillator, eigenfrequency, does not depend upon the voltage you apply to it or the flux. So now we've, in this case, so we want to park our qubit over here, because now the actual eigenfrequency or the phase of evolution of the qubit does not depend upon the control parameters. And that's sort of like, it's basically just determined by this geometric length. And that's good for making a qubit. Now, in this region here, the qubit's very strongly coupled to the environment, so you want to make, it's the usual Josephson one where you have a ground state that's symmetric wave function, the first excited state's asymmetric. And that's where you couple the qubit to the other environments. So you've got three things you can do. You can make it macroscopic for readout and setting it. You can make it decoupled from the environment for a long lifetime. And you can make it strongly coupled to nearby qubits to do gate operations. So that's what we want to do. And that's what drives us. And you'll see, that's our vision. So this is what the actual qubit looks like. There's the qubit. Here's this transmission line. It's a superconducting transmission line. And these are the drive circuits that generate the noise that we have to deal with. And now to read out the qubit, we basically bring it over here, which is called home base. This is called parking. We start the qubit over on home base and do classical classical operations. You tilt the potential, and we can end up in the left or the right well. And then we go up to parking and let it sit there for a while. And then we go back. And then when we measure, so we measure the qubit. In this operation here, the system becomes classical. And then we can just measure the qubit with a squid. The two eigenstates of the qubit, 0 or 1, correspond to current flowing like this, or like this on these lines. And this transmission line does double duty. It just measures the current flowing around this loop. So what does this qubit look like? In reality, this is it. It's about 500 microns across. And I say, holy cow, why is it so big? And, most Josephson qubits are much smaller. And the reason why we make these qubits big is because we want to solve the problem of control crosstalk. In other words, if you pulse onto this circuit here, which is the control flux, you don't want any crosstalk to this line or crosstalk to that line. And you'll see, I'll talk about this a little later. So by making the qubit big and putting it on a ground plane, we can localize the effects of the controls. But this is the standard aluminum junction shadow technology. There's the junction. We've made very small junctions. We typically use about 200 by 200 nanometers across. And as you'll see later in Jan's talk, there is the real issue on these Josephson junctions. There's charge trapping in these junctions, and that's a source of noise that one has to deal with, and we have to deal with it as well. But these aluminum junctions are very reliable, and the fact that aluminum has a TC of around 1.1 Kelvin doesn't really hurt us, because we, of course, have to operate our system much colder than that. Now, another interesting thing that we do, which is totally different than everybody else as far as I know, we have a stick-built qubit. And I say, what is a stick-built qubit? Most Josephson qubits are done integrated. They deposit the lines, and they deposit insulators, and they deposit crossover lines, then they deposit junctions. So they build up this stack of materials that has all these lossy dielectrics in it. And as I pointed out, and I think you'll see later, lossy dielectrics cause defects. They have defects in them. It's impossible to have an amorphous dielectric, which all these dielectrics are, have defects in them, and that causes decoherence. So our qubit is stick-built, and by that I mean the way we build this qubit is sort of shown here. This is the, you know, these are the SSMA connectors, and this is a piece of silicon. So the way we do this, we take a piece of silicon here, and then we deposit niobium on it. That's the ground plane, and we put that down. And then we take another very thin piece of silicon. It's like 60 microns thick, so it's just like paper. And we deposit the control structures for the qubit on top of that. So you can hardly see them. I see these lines here are the control transmission lines. So it's these lines here, and this line here. Those are deposited on this very thin piece of paper-like silicon, and then we mechanically place this thing on top like that. And then we deposit on another substrate this structure here, this aluminum qubit made out of aluminum. And you can see here it is. Here it's sitting on top of this structure. And then we mechanically, so we got our qubit here, and I could have drawn the little qubit on this piece of paper. And then we mechanically just place that on top. I say, now why do you do it like that? And the reason is, if you think about, there's no lossy amorphous dielectrics in that structure. The only thing, it's a very simple material set. It's niobium, it's aluminum, it's silicon, single crystal silicon, and there's always, of course, the junction oxides. So this is a way we've designed our qubit, the mechanical layout of our qubit, to avoid the problems of having lossy dielectrics in the qubit, which is the biggest, you know, one of the biggest problems facing most Josephson junction qubits.
Is the
mechanical
registration challenging?
No.
And crucial?
It's crucial. If you want to build a scalable machine, it's absolutely crucial. Because what happens, of course, you don't get the mutual inductances aren't perfectly lined up. You know, we can mechanically register to maybe a few tenths of a micron under a microscope. So that means that the mutual inductance between the mutual inductance between this coil and this thing will be different a little bit every time because it's not lined up perfectly. So if you're going to build one or two, it doesn't make any difference. If you're going to build a scalable machine, you have to do this all integrated. You can use a couple different approaches. Photoresist, or actually we've been trying GE varnish. And of course we don't put when you do this, you have to be very, very careful about this. You know, this thing here, you don't put the GE varnish so it's over top of the qubit. You've got to somehow just get it around the edges here. And then you say, how do you know? Then you only get to know that afterwards. You pull the whole thing off and you see if the GE varnish was, you know, over the qubit or not. The same thing here. There's this couple, like four dots of GE varnish or photoresist around the edges there. So that, and you'll see, this is not a scalable technology, but it also solves a yield problem. Because if you are making this thing takes a lot of silicon, right? But you can get 100% yield on these wires. The low level of yield you get is on this qubit. So you can make thousands of these, and you break into little pieces, you measure them, and if they're good, you mount them on the thing here. And this little thing here is the ruler. This little piece of plastic here. You got your transmission line here, and you got your qubit here, and then you go, but how do you line them up? So you got to have a ruler. And the ruler, if you look here carefully, there's a line on this ruler like this and like this, and that's lined up with these transmission lines. And on a separate thing, we align the ruler to the qubit. So when we line everything up, we're lining it up ruler to the qubit. So that's the basic mechanical layout. Now, how do we actually operate this qubit? And you know, and again, I mean, most of you, you know, most people operate Josephs and qubits the same way they operate ion traps. You apply microwaves, and you know, you rotate the, you do Lamar oscillations to try to do pi pulses or pi over two pulses, whatever you like. You know, we don't have any of that. We don't have any of that ability because we're just doing pulses. So the way we do this is we call this thing, this is called the Rosetta plot, this plot here. And it's a plot of the flux in this loop parameterized by the control flux. So each one of these loops here, you know, so you start here and we ramp out here in flux and ramp back and ramp here this way. And each loop corresponds to a different value of control flux. So we start off with and remember the control flux is this little flux. And what we're plotting on this loop is the squid signal. Now the squid signal, remember, measures the current going around the outside of this loop here. So you can see when we go out this way and come back, there's hysteresis. And that hysteresis tells you that we're in the double well limit. So the way this works is, wash my hands here, all right? So we start off at point A, and then when you go to point B, you're tilting the potential like this, it turns out. So the system falls into this classically, and then it comes back, and now we're on the left, and that would mean we're on the bottom there, part of point A. If we go this way and tilt, we would end up over here and then come back. Now we're in the right well, which corresponds to being up here. And you can see now as we increase the control flux, notice this hysteresis becomes smaller and smaller because the barriers get becoming smaller and smaller as we increase the control flux. So the way we do this operation, we start at point A, we go over to point B and back to prepare the system on let's say the bottom down here, and then we very quickly ramp up to point C where the barrier is very small, and then we coherently oscillate between the ground and the first excited state, and then we go back to point A and measure. And to give you an idea of this is why we call this Rosetta plot. This is the simulated Rosetta plot. So there's point A, the home base. There's the reading point, and up there is the parking point. Start here, go out here, prepare the state, go out here, and come back and measure where we are. Here's a measured curve. The same thing. And you can see if you look carefully here, this measured curve looks exactly like this predicted curve, except it's tilted. You say, well, why is it tilted? It's not supposed to be tilted. But the reason why it's tilted is because of this crosstalk issue. You know, which if you talk to people who, you can always tell where people are on building quantum computers in terms of, do they understand the importance of crosstalk? If you say crosstalk to them and you get a blank look on their face, then you know they're not very far along the way. And this is crosstalk. And if, you know, the crosstalk is just because in this thing, if you pulse this, and you can see this design here is inadvertently asymmetric. You know, you pulse this, there's going to be some pickup on this loop or some driving of this loop. That's why you see this crosstalk. The two controls are coupled together. And you can see, so once we understood that, we realized we had to do something about that, and I'll show you what we did about that. Okay, so what do we see? When we did, this is data, it's probably about 2 years old now. This is the first really nice data we saw. And basically, as a function of the pulse width, or how long we stayed at this point, we saw oscillations. And this is 10 to 30 nanoseconds. You can see oscillations that have a visibility or, you know, a fidelity of about 60% between start. This is zero switching would be starting in the initial well that you started, and over here would be you'd be switching to the other well. So those are Lamar oscillations of the transmission line. You know, those really crappy oscillations I showed you way back when I started, those were oscillations of the qubit. But you can see now these oscillations are much nicer. And, of course, you know, they vanish at about 50 nanoseconds. but I'll try to explain that in a second why. These oscillations are absolutely always occur at the same frequency. And the reason why they occur at the same frequency is because they're oscillations of the ground state of this transmission line. And they don't really depend upon how you biased the transmission line, because it's more or less independent of that. And you think, well, you know, that's not really good. You know, for trying to demonstrate quantum mechanics, you can't do Rabi oscillations, which is this, you know, the standard way you prove you got yourself a working qubit. And, you know, because that's true, I can't do that. But I don't really care, because everyone, you know, there's no doubt these are the quantum mechanical systems. What you really want is a way to have a system which behaves predictably independent of the control parameters. And that's what this transmission line does for you. Now, the other, I have, you know, I skipped over the whole idea of the portal, so I won't talk about this, but it's this way of generating a coherence out of a ground state is going through this portal, and it's very robust. Now, as we, the best decoherence time we've gotten is about 95 nanoseconds. And, you know, in this original design, there's a fatal flaw. And the fatal flaw is we've got this nice transmission line here, which we've measured to have a Q of about 30,000, or a decoherence time of like 20 microseconds by itself. But then we hang on this readout device, which has got a lot of real lossy rate. So that's it's essentially a T1 effect. So, you know, the decoherence time in our cases is just the T1 of the the effective T1 of the transmission line when it's loaded with the squid. That loads it down. There's some other things, here's an interesting plot where we've changed the magnitude of the pulse. So we increase the amplitude of this control pulse by about 3%, and you can see that the oscillations start. Now David and I, both have 4-year-olds, so we call this plot the ice cream cone plot, which I'm going to show you. But then we started working with all these defense contractors, and they all called it the martini plot. So it looks like this. So this is the home base. Here's the parking point, or the cherry on the top of the ice cream cone. This is the parking line. Any place above this line, you're parked. And this is the portal that I'm going to avoid talking about. So that just gives you, this is the parking point. And what I'm saying is, if you're here when you're below parking, you're basically determined by the decoherence of the qubit, which right now is not very good for us, and we're working a lot on doing that. So you don't see any coherent oscillations, just noise. As soon as you get to the point where the qubit is the eigenfrequency of the qubit is stabilized by the transmission line, you start to see oscillations. Now, and here's another, just a fun, here's the plot of the measured versus the predicted oscillations. And you can see that the predicted are much crappier than the measured, because, you know, when you predict these things, you can only run the simulation like 100 times in a day, where these are, you know, thousands of shots. And it looks reasonably well, although, this, you know, all this stuff here is really just due to the finite number of predictions we did. Now let me talk about how we do gate operations on this qubit. So here's the martini plot. And now in our newer designs, we're starting up here. To initialize, we just go down, over, like this and like that, and that initializes the system. So we start in up here where there's no wells. We're coupled. We make a double well potential, tilt it, and come back. And now we've got ourselves an initialized state. To do a Z gate, we just go down here and hold it. Because a Z gate is just basically a straightforward gate. The escape is a little harder to do, and I won't talk about why that is right now. And to measure, we just go down to the bottom there and determine whether in the left or the right well. But now why? Now, I want to talk now about, I think, is the newest thing, the most important message I have for you, and that's the joy of parking. Because unlike ion traps, the key problem, the key scalability problem of Josephson technology for qubits is the fact that unless you do something very special, the qubits are all coupled together. You say, oh, the Josephson qubits are easy to couple together. You can couple them together with a capacitor or an inductor. But the problem is that's too strong a coupling. So when you start playing around with one qubit, you do something to every other qubit that's coupled to it. And if you have the capacitors coupled to it or inductors coupled to it, all the qubits together, you end up with an incredible mess. And if you look at the latest developments in Josephson qubit technology, it's all about removing unavoided coupling between qubits. That's the biggest problem we face. And our solution to this is parking, like I said before. So if you want to do a ZZ gate, which is the same kind of thing as a CNOT, you can work out, and I could show you if you wanted to, that what you do is you take your two qubits here, and you just bring them down from the parking point down to the portal line somewhere over here, a little bit off the center. So you sort of come down like this. You start here and come down about there, and you got the other qubit over here, and you do the same thing. And that'll effectively do a ZZ gate on the pair of qubits. But now, if you didn't have parking, if this qubit wasn't parked, it was sitting down here, this coupling between these two transmission lines, which is you want to have coupled together, is also over here, because eventually you want to do a ZZ gate between these qubits. And it would also affect this qubit in a big way. And that's not good. But this qubit is parked. It's up here on this transmission line state, up there, so that nothing happens to it. So that's how you isolate the control of the different qubits when you do gate operations.
So you're limited to doing, it sounds like you've got all your qubits here on one chip. You're limited to doing two qubits at a time anywhere on the chip.
Well, no, but you could have another one over here, another pair over there. I mean, we would do our qubits in two-dimensional arrays. So if this one gets affected, there's going to be some coupling to this one, to this one, this one. So you can't do, you could in principle you have to have them a little further apart. You have to keep all its nearest neighbors parked while you do a pair, and maybe you have to do its next nearest neighbors as well. But this is a much, much cleaner solution than just having a fixed coupling. And the other solution is to put active elements in there, which just another problem to deal with. So parking is really great. That's really why we do what we do is driven by this. Because if we don't have this, we don't think you can actually do Josephson computers using any existing techniques. I've got about 10 minutes left, and let me just talk about some of the design issues of making a real computer. The first thing is you have to operate the qubit at a degenerate point. Now, by that I mean is that as a function of the control parameters, the eigenfrequencies are independent of the control parameter. And the parking is the ultimate degenerate point, right? But even down here, when you do gate operations, you have to operate a degenerate point. Why? Because of this. This is probably the biggest physics issue facing Josephson computers, decoherence from 1/f flux noise. I was back in 1982, I think for various reasons, I was the first person, or the first, we were the first group to actually demonstrate that there is a flux noise in a squib. This was a superconducting loop. And at that time, the noise level was 10 microfinot per root hertz at 1 hertz. And, you know, in 25 years or so, the number's gotten about a factor of 10 better. But it's a really unknown source of noise. And how big is that noise? Well, think of, you know, if I look at the noise temperature of the system, you know, right now most of our experiments are done at 30 millikelvin. So in principle, our thermal noise should be at 30 millikelvin here. And that's the actual. Now, if I take this one of our squibs here, and, you know, there's this flux noise that's effectively in this loop, and I convert it back to an effective noise as a function of temperature noise, what would that effective temperature noise be? It's this. It's like it goes at 1 hertz, it's about 10 to the 8th Kelvin. That's how big it is. And you can see that in the knee, you know, if the knee is about on the order of a gigahertz. Now, of course, it may, you know, depending on how you couple it, maybe a tenth of a gigahertz, or maybe more or less. That's how big of a noise this problem is, if you convert it to noise temperature. Now, again, that doesn't mean that there's something at that temperature. That's the effective noise temperature from the one of ref noise. And so when you design an operation of the qubit, you have got to deal with the fact that you have to work at a degenerate point. Because at this degenerate point, then you can essentially cancel this noise out. And if you look at all the really good qubits out there, you know, the ones that we all look up to, like the Delft qubit and the Saclay qubit, they operate that performance. They get that tremendous performance at degenerate point. If they go off that degenerate point, their decoherence time goes from microseconds to tens of nanoseconds.
You're not hooking up to the phase qubit?
Pardon?
You're not hooking up to the phase qubit?
Well, in terms of working at a degenerate point,
yeah,
they can't. That's a real problem for them. That's why I don't. Well, you'll see what I say about the phase qubit. Oh, you need more. You need a lot of qubits. Yeah, yeah, yeah. And the way. Oh, they're not good enough yet. That's for sure. They're not good enough yet. But they're still very. I wish we had that number. You know, we got 20, you got 100 nanoseconds. The phase qubit is around 100 nanoseconds too. That's why I'm not looking. I mean, it's a great qubit, but it's really hard to imagine getting the coherence time up unless you can solve this one of ref noise problem. And when we do these operations, we always do them in pairs to deal with this effect. Now, the other problem is these two qubits, these beautiful qubits, they're not tunable at the degenerate point. Because if you're going to build a real computer, you have to have everybody doing everything exactly synchronized at the right frequency. Like an atom. You know, when you do an NMR computer or an ion trap, you know what those frequencies are, and you build your whole control scheme based on those frequencies. And they don't change during the operation of your computer. Now, but if you have an ordinary flux qubit or an ordinary Saclay qubit, and you operate at the degenerate point to get the high performance, the frequency which that thing operates at is going to depend from qubit to qubit to qubit because, you know, the way it's built. So you have to deal with that problem. And from an engineering point of view of making a millionth qubit machine, it's intractable. So that's why we want a qubit that's tunable. Now, the phase qubit sort of is in between there. The phase qubit's tunable, but it can't operate at a degenerate point. The charge qubit and the flux qubit are operate at a degenerate point, but they're not tunable. Our qubit, which is probably the worst performing of the three of them so far, can do both. And finally, we want to be able to park, like I said before, to make the qubit insensitive to environmental noise and to convert the system from a voltage-controlled oscillator to a crystal oscillator. Because you need precise time and coherence times. And if you look at the different ideas out there, you know, this very famous idea that came out of IBM in Switzerland in Bern, I guess it is, this charged spin qubit, you know, the crosstalk on this thing is unbelievable. So, you know, my sense is that people who are actually doing this are having to modify their ideas. Probably one of the nicest two junction qubits so far is the Santa Barbara NIST two phase qubits. And notice how they've got these things really far apart to avoid crosstalk. That's why you want them big. You know, this is too small. You can't avoid crosstalk if it's too small. And the same thing, we go through this whole process of parking the qubit to avoid crosstalk. Okay, so now what are we actually doing in terms of building a bigger machine? So here's our new design of qubit that we've made now. You know, there's the basic design, there's the resonator, there's the flux and control flux line, and we're going to a Delft style readout squid. And here's the design, how we coupled them together. And all this readout electronics that I won't go into now. And here it is. That's the circuit. That's what's actually built. Now, we've tested these things at 300 millikelvin, and actually this mutual inductance here was off, so we have to make another design, which will take another couple of weeks, but we haven't put the design in the solution refrigerator to test it yet. So that's about where we are. But as far as we can tell, we can do this. And we actually do this with 3DI. This way is not so great, right? Got us there in a hurry, so to speak, but you really need something better. So what we actually do is this. We take a piece of silicon, 1,000 micron wafer. That's a very thick piece of silicon. We put copper on it. We take the other wafer, that's a 600 micron wafer. We put niobium on the bottom, we put copper on, and we take these two wafers and we bond them together in a press. Takes about 8 hours of pressing, and they'll be bonded together as one wafer. So now we've got ourselves the embedded ground plane we need instead of the stick build approach. And then we put this on. And when putting this on, listen, a funny design. There's no crossovers here. The only crossover is right here at this point and here. And so, and that crossover, yeah, that's going to have silicon oxide on it, which is going to cause trapping, but you know it's not really in the qubit itself. It's just in the readout squid. So we hope we'll be able to get away with that. And that's basically our approach to try to do an integrated squid. And then what we want to do is we take these things and put them together. Okay, so here's our qubit design. We fold the resonator up in order to make it smaller, and then. You know, if you look at, you know, there's a lot of theorists at IBM, and they keep telling us, you know, you want to make something that really has a good, a high threshold, which is good, you want a 2D array, as Eli was talking about yesterday. You want a 2D array. A 1D array doesn't have such a large, the threshold's too small. So the question is, how are you going to get yourself a 2D array of qubits when you have to deal with all this electronics? You know, and for a while they're saying, well, you can only do this with ion traps, because ion traps only can come in from the top, so to speak. So then we had the idea, why not use what we call, it's a common thing now, it's called 3DI, 3D integration. And this looks amazing, but you know, if you talk to people who actually do this, this is pretty much what they do already. The idea that we're looking for is we're going to make this chip here, and like I said, we've made this chip already, and we've had 5 qubits on it, and then you take this chip, and you have another set of chips here that are held in place by a carrier, and you've got a bunch of chips here that have all the electronics on, and then you just mechanically place this thing together, and you know you use solder bonds here between these circuits and these circuits. Now, people don't do that in conventional electronics because heat. Now, if you tried to do this in a conventional room temperature thing, you could get a huge density of circuits, right? Unbelievable density of circuits. But the heat would kill you. all this, you know, it's hard enough to cool an ordinary CMOS circuit, just a planar circuit, but if you have this circuit, there's no way. But people think about this, and you know, they have these channels, and they imagine running cooling water through these channels, or, you know, cooling liquids. It's amazing. So that's what we want to try. And of course, the heat's not so much an issue here, because our whole circuit can't, you know, dissipate more than a few hundred microwatts already. So that's our long-term vision. Of course, this is, you know, I've got a lot more detailed drawings here that I won't try to bore you with. So, and then you build this thing in the usual conventional way. You got your qubits down here, and your pulse generators at room temperature, and a bunch of multiplexers down here to take these pulses and route them to the proper qubits. So let me summarize. So what we've done is we've developed a qubit that can operate at a degenerate point with a tunable operating frequency, even though the critical current of the junctions may vary. And this is the interchangeable part qubit, which is what you need. You know, basically, you can imagine taking this qubit out of a circuit. You have a large computer, take one qubit out of the circuit, put another one in, adjust the DC operating points of that qubit, and the algorithm that you execute on that computer is unchanged. It's an interchangeable part qubit. That's what you need in order to make a real quantum computer. And we achieve that by stabilizing the frequency of the qubit with a transmission line. And just to give you an idea of where, at least I think, where people are, if you want to make a game-changing factoring engine, that's a machine that could factor a 200-digit number in 1,000 seconds, that's about 10 to the 12th ops. You'll need you need about 1,000 logical qubits. Each logical qubit probably corresponds to about 1,000 physical qubits, so you're talking about 1,000,000 physical qubits here in order to make a real game-changing machine. You need about a 10 nanosecond clock, which we think we can do, and a coherence time of 10 milliseconds, which is even a stretch even for a superconducting transmission line. It's not impossible to do, and this is a rough idea where we are. But let me end with, I think, the most important message I can give anyone here. You know, the message is that, you know, I think most of us like quantum physics or quantum computing. You know, there's some of the people here aren't really into quantum computing. Most of the audience that I talk to are. But this computer is too expensive for the government to buy. You know, everyone, you know, the government, you know, has one purpose, right? They want to factor large numbers to break codes. They can't afford this. Because the cost of building a computer like this is in the multi-billions of dollars, and it has to be done by a lot of people who aren't all going to get yourself security clearances and work on these classified contracts. So there has to be another application. If there's no other application besides factoring, you know, quantum computing will be like, you know, costless salvage transitions. You know, not many people work on them anymore. So that's the most important message. If you're a mathematician, or if you're somebody who has a real problem you want to solve, you know, a problem that you want to solve so badly that you're building special purpose machines, you're the person who's going to save quantum computing. Thank you.